Welcome to Season 6 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We'll be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day, and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the sciences. Today, our guest is Mike Dolce. Mike is one of the most well-known and respected trainers, not just in combat sports, but in the health and fitness industry. Across his more than 20-year career, he's been awarded World MMA Trainer of the Year not once, but four times. He is a best-selling author of his wildly successful book, The Dolce Diet, 3 Weeks to Shredded, and is the go-to weight management coach to elite-level athletes, business people, and everyday warriors. In the world of mixed martial arts, Mike paved the path for many of us who are currently working in combat sports nutrition. He was the go-to nutrition coach for the likes of Ronda Rousey, Randy Couture, Quinton Rampage Jackson, Johnny Hendricks, Vitor Belfort, Chael Sonnen, Dwayne Ludwig, Michael Bisping, Gilbert Melendez, and many, many more. I've been wanting to get Mike on the show for a long time, and in this episode, we'll be discussing his career, his philosophy behind weight management in MMA, how he has seen the industry change in the past 20 years, common mistakes he sees athletes make, and what he believes is the best answer to the weight cutting issue. If there is one episode of the Fight Science Podcast you do not want to miss, it is this one. So let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Now, every episode I always start and say we have a very special guest, but I think today's episode, this is probably one of the most special guests I've ever had on the podcast. I've been looking forward to getting this person on because this person has paved the way for pretty much everyone who works in this industry. Everyone who works in combat sports nutrition would have heard of this guy, would have his book in their bookshelf and would have read it, would have read his work and would be following along with him. So very happy to introduce and have on Mr. Mike Dolce to the show.
Thanks, Jordy, brother. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. Big fan of your work and just all the great things that you're doing out there for the community. So happy to be peers, honored to be peers, by the way, and excited for the conversation.
No, happy to have you on, Mike. Like I said, when I think of this industry, I kind of think of it, my career's only been about 5-6 years. And then I think, you know what, man, there's so much I don't know about this. And I think, man, and then, you know, people like you are a dime in a dozen that have so much experience in this field. And I'm looking forward to cracking open into that and getting some of that knowledge and that wisdom, getting your take on how the field's evolved. Because even when I've been involved with it, in 5 years, it's changed. It's been so crazy. But Mike, that's a good way to start this. I'm not big on getting everyone's history and spending a lot of time on there because there's more important things. But yours is probably one of the most interesting since you've been doing this for so long. How did you get started? How did you get started in this crazy world?
I grew up as a high school and college wrestler, right? So I've been cutting weight since I was 13 years old. And as a preface to that, I watched my father have a massive stroke when I was 8 years old, and he was in and out of the, you know, healthcare and hospice, and he wound up, you know, passing away, massive heart attack, stroke, lifestyle related illness, right? So I spent a good amount of my childhood in and out of doctor's offices and hospitals and all the things that kind of go with that. So then fast forward into the education side, I always excelled in math and science. I loved it. I was passionate about it and I had an aptitude for it, but also I loved combat sports. I loved to, like, I played all the sports, but I loved wrestling. I loved boxing. I loved those things. And at 13 years old, I was a 4-year varsity wrestler. And I don't know, you know, internationally how that is. That's pretty rare. And I was a 4-year captain. So as a 13-year-old freshman on the team, I was actually voted a captain. So I was in charge of the 18-year-old seniors, which is kind of a big deal. But I think it's because I already had an aptitude, again, for some of the strength, conditioning, nutrition even. And I had a leadership capacity, I say this humbly, in that I was the first guy there. And I was always prepared. And I was always encouraging my teammates to do more. And I was in there in it with them, you know, cause I was just trying to earn my way out of poverty in many ways. And I had that internal drive and I just wanted to share that. So then as I kind of, you know, I'll fast forward through many years, as I go through, I opened my training business in 1993, officially. I was a junior in high school in 1993. I opened my personal training business, Physical Enterprises, by the way, was the name of it. And I was working with combat athletes. I was working with a lot of the college wrestlers. I mean, I had gone out and I spent 3 weeks in Iowa at 17 years old with Dan Gable, the Brands Brothers, Mark Ryland. I mean, some of the greatest wrestlers in the world. I got to live with them for 3 weeks, you know, my junior year going into senior year of high school. And that, of course, rubbed off on me. So to distill this down a little bit more, I never took my hand out of the combat sports field, but I had to make money. And I got a big boy job working in real estate finance. Again, having a math background, it was valuation and amortization and, you know, all that kind of boring stuff. I really enjoyed that. And I was taking the train. My college wrestling career was now over. I'm in my early 20s. I started powerlifting, which is another weight class oriented sport, on the opposite spectrum, which was just great for me to really hone my craft at that level. And I started training jiu-jitsu with Henzo Gracie through his affiliates. And then in a short period of time, I was training with Henzo, John Donaher, Igor, Gregor Gracie, Daniel Gracie, back Hyen, who was still there on the mats at that time, for those who understand the Gracie lineage. And I was solicited by a lot of the athletes because of my coaching capacity. And it really kind of just continued on, Jordy. And it was just, it wasn't something I was looking to do, but the athletes were drawn to me in a way. And then I was able to add value to them. And this thing just kept growing. And then in 2004, I was contacted. I met the guys from Team Quest, Randy Couture and Matt Linlin and Robert Follis in 04. And they invited me to come out to be the head strength coach of Team Quest North, which is the number one fight team in the world, back in 04 to 05. And I accepted the position when Randy was getting ready to fight Tito Ortiz. So in the middle of that camp, beginning of that camp is when I was brought in to be the head strength coach. And that was kind of 04 and 05 before the Ultimate Fighter won and all that stuff. And then, I mean, the career just kept going. Of course, there's no money in it. I quit my job, by the way. A real estate finance guy, I quit that job. I was like, oh, I'm all in on this horrible sport nobody knows about that has absolutely zero money. Like, yeah, sign me up for that one. This is a great career move right now. So that's kind of my, you know, hopefully I didn't go on ramble too long, but that's a little bit of the background of what got me into the UFC kind of sphere.
No, that's crazy. And I think everyone kind of has that similar story, right? It's like everyone trains themselves and then it's almost out of necessity, right? Like these guys just see you and they go, oh, you know what? Like, I do suck at cutting weight and Mike seems to have a good idea about it. I'll help you. And then they tell their friend and it just snowballs. And one thing I've heard you talk about, Mike, that I love, and I love that you talk about this and this is the direction that you're taking your company, is that you describe your company not so much as a sports performance company, but a longevity company. Can you describe what that means and what drives your company's values?
Yeah. And thank you for that question, Jordy. Great opportunity. I watched my father die as a result of lifestyle related illness. And that I didn't realize what an impact that had on me as an 8-year-old boy who lost his father and grew up fatherless and then eventually homeless because the whole home went into poverty and the home was taken away. It's like my whole life, my family's life was destroyed. And that was very formative to me. And what I do, I'm a very empathetic person. And when I work with the athletes and throughout my entire career, I would always see not just the athlete getting across the finish line, but what happens next. And then being in the sport, being in the combat world. I mean, I've been in the combat world since the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, back when there was only 4 UFCs a year and they weren't even allowed on pay-per-view because they were banned, right? I was working with athletes at that period of time. So a lot of those athletes now, well, they're in their 50s and 60s, and some of them can't say their name. Some of them forget the name of their children, right? And I was uniquely aware of that, and I always hearken back to being that little boy losing his own father, and that was formative to me, and it's formative to the core culture of our company. And when I was in my mid-20s and I was powerlifting, I brought my body weight up to 282 pounds to compete as a super heavyweight powerlifter. I know, 5'10", stupid. But I wanted to squat 600 pounds, and I did that as a teenager, and then 700 pounds, and then 800 pounds, because in powerlifting, it's just about more weight. And in order to lift more weight, well, you have to weigh more. You have to get bigger. That's kind of the way that it went. And I remember I sat in my doctor's office, a routine checkup when I was still working in real estate finance, And my doctor, Dr. Lau, little Asian lady, and God, she was like 100 years old back then. Hopefully she's still around now. This is going back, 20 some odd years now. And she comes out, she went in the back and she comes out and I'm sitting down in the chair and she's like, she's standing up and we're like eye to eye. I'm sitting in the chair. She's this tiny little Asian lady, she's amazing. And she was my father's doctor, right? So she had, a little more of a connection to our family. And she points her finger in my chest. She's like, what are you doing? Like, you are a stupid boy. Like, you know better than this. Like, you look like a 55-year-old man, a very sick man. And I was like, holy shit. I had sleep apnea. I had an arrhythmia. I was 282 pounds at like 30 some odd percent body fat. I would eat two full dinners, garlic bread. And like, I just gorged myself to gain weight, but I could squat 800 pounds. So hoorah, sports performance, right? I was so focused on getting across the finish line first, I didn't even consider my health. And I was educated at this point. I knew how to manipulate the science to win, to move more weight, to build more muscle, to do that thing. And that drive home, everything changed. I remember driving down Route 33 in Freehold. I remember the drive perfectly right now. It was such again, a formative period in my life. And I realized, what am I doing to myself? For a plastic trophy, the last powerlifting meet I had, my mom was there and my girlfriend was there. And like maybe the mom and girlfriends of like the 11 other guys in the meet. And that was it, in like a high school gym. Like, what am I doing to myself? Like, it was so surreal. And from that point forward, and my business was kind of still ramping up, and I decided immediately to change and to focus on longevity science, not sports performance science. And I always tested on myself first. But what I noticed, and I was still working with national level wrestlers, NCAA, D1, national champions, and the highest tier of athletes I was working with at this time, the guys from, Henzo Gracie and that fight team and whatnot. What we saw across the board is a dramatic boost of performance. When we forgot about the protein, the carbs, the fats, managing the macros, and I really did start taking a deeper dive into the micronutrient level, the deeper cellular level, cellular interactions, what was actually happening on a hormonal level, a biochemical level. And also, number one rule is do no harm. When that became the guiding light for my career is do no harm. And I do attribute that to the success of all of our athletes. We've never had an athlete ever miss weight. And it's very rare when you think about the name of the athletes that we've worked. We work with the worst of the best, I like to say. The worst weight cutters in the world. The biggest problem children. Dane and Lorenzo would send them to me. I'm like, are you kidding me? They're like, nobody else can get it done. And we already spent $4 million to market this fight. Like, go ahead, Dolce, do your thing. I was like, holy shit. Like, that was like behind the scenes right now. So kind of to take it forward, longevity is everything. And I say that now, and I'll close it here. When I work with an athlete, I tell them, number one, I don't care if you win or lose this fight. Number two, I don't care if you make weight for this fight. Number three, my only care is for you to tell your great-grandchildren about the time you made weight and won this fight. That's the way I'm operating. And if that's not good for you, I can't be a part of this camp. We're going to make sure that we do nothing to harm your long-term health outcome. And in fact, everything we do from this moment forward will be to improve your long-term health outcomes. And if you're on board with that, let's get in and let's get after it. And that's kind of been the way I've operated my company for, 20 plus years now.
Yeah, incredible to hear, eh? Because it's such a skill in itself, right? And you compete, you've been an athlete, you've worked with hundreds of thousands of athletes at the elite level. You know how fixated they are on that goal. They don't care about long-term. Everything is short-term. I want that belt. I want to get to the top five. I want to do that. It's a skill in itself, isn't it, to be able to counsel them and to change their psychology and their thinking and towards that, to have that thought of longevity. So it's so good to hear, Mike. I think that's a perfect segue, though. So let's start talking about making weight. Let's start talking about weight cutting. What are your thoughts? You've seen it all. You've seen it all when it comes to this industry. What are your thoughts on the current state of weight cutting? Let's talk about MMA specifically. Not so much. We can talk about all combat sports, powerlifting, but let's talk about MMA. What are your thoughts on the current state of weight cutting in MMA?
I think the culture of weight cutting has not progressed in 100 years. weight cutting is still dominated by what I used to do works. It's that old school, old wives' tale mentality of what worked for my coach worked for me, and that's going to work for you. And you see that being passed down, unfortunately, because the wrong coaches are teaching weight cutting. It's not great, highly skilled, passionate, educated practitioners like yourself. Athletes who work with you and your team, Jordy, are very lucky, and I hope they understand how lucky they actually are. Most of the athletes out there are being told how to cut weight by a boxer or a wrestler or a jiu-jitsu guy or a bodybuilder who's on a bunch of drugs, not by a true professional. And this is one of the biggest issues. Now, thank God, Dr. Duncan French and the UFCPI has come in to help. But as great as they are and as much service as they've provided, it's not accepted by the majority of the teams. They're going to use it for free food. They're using them for a little bit of freebies, but they're slapping away the science. They're not embracing the science. And that's unfortunate. And I butt heads all the time. I'm very vocal. I'm fortunate to be in a position to not really care what people think about me or say about me. And I don't have to worry. Like, I don't even want to work with you. Like, you can't hire me. Like, how about that? And like, no, you can't hire me. And like, I'm not going to consult with you. Like, I'm fine. Like, I don't need that. So I can speak and be very vocal, which I think is a good thing. And you know, I know it rubs some people the wrong way, but the things I say are not true and they need to be said with regards to the industry. Athletes need to spend the time and money to be working with highly skilled weight management professionals and not idiots like George Lockhart, who I believe is the most dangerous con man in the game, personal opinion. And when you look at the list of bodies that is on his resume of athletes who have missed weight, who have been pulled from carts, who have been hospitalized time and time again, we see that. And that's unfortunate that and he's not the only one. There's quite a few that are out there, but he's the one who I believe is most deceptive in falsely portraying his skill set and his resume. And athletes buy into that, and then they are severely hurt and damaged by that. And then he makes the rest of the industry look bad. That becomes the standard of that type of suffering and deprivation and bro science, unfortunately, where athletes will listen to their jiu-jitsu coach about how to cut weight because their jiu-jitsu coach won a world title once upon a time. Well, he probably damn near died on his way to do it. And his opponent probably damn near died on the way to do it. We have I work with a lot of collegiate wrestlers and I consult with a lot of teams and even consulted with USA Wrestling. And there's a joke that the average high school, college, world champion wrestler, world-class wrestler, it's an agreement, gentleman's agreement, we say. We're both going to compete at 60% of our ability because the weight cut is going to fuck us that hard to just get on the mat to compete. And you understand that. That's unacceptable. That's unacceptable in my world. So to kind of, to tie this loop up, the science, I mean, this iPhone right now, what we're doing, Jordy, you're in New Zealand in quarantine right now. You and I can have a real world free-flowing conversation. Millions of people can see this like that, no problem. Science has advanced rapidly in all sectors of the world, including weight management and performance and nutrition and biochemistry. And we'll go down the list. The answers are there. You're doing a great job in your team with all your research and all your studies. Again, Dr. Andy Galpin is doing an amazing job, and to put him on, and Tony Ricci, of course, and Dr. Corey Peacock, just to name a few of the names out there who are doing amazing work. The information is out there, but the athletes aren't accepting it. And many times, in my opinion, they're being forced, or it's being hidden from them by those who want a piece of candy. Right? They want to be in the limelight. They want to get the selfie, like point at me, save me, mention my name. I'll carry your bags. I'll cook your chicken breast. I once upon a time when I was an athlete, this is what I did. I have no credentials and no experience and no history and no education, but I'm going to tell you what to do. Blue chip, world-class, 6-7-figure athlete. I'm going to somehow tell you what to do in this field. And all the things that I'm saying right now, these are all true. Nothing I've said is a lie or it's inaccurate. This is all true. This is all happening right now. We just had a young lady miss weight in the UFC by 3+ pounds. We've had athletes miss weight by 5 pounds or more. We've had athletes in the UFC in the year 2021 collapsing on the scale, right? The highest level of sports. This is happening right now. Elon Musk is sending, you know, machinery to Mars. I can watch HD 5K imagery of the surface of Mars. My daughters are sitting home watching that. And we can't get an athlete to step on the scale and be healthy at the UFC, the highest level. This makes no sense. Not because the science is there, not because great coaches like yourself are not ready to assist, because the athletes are simply not embracing it and accepting it. And I believe, in my experience, 20 plus years in the game, it's because of the ego and the narcissism and the greed of the individual athlete and of those around them. That's my true belief. Knowing what I know and seeing what I've seen, they don't want to pay, you know, Jordy and the fight dietitian, they don't want to pay you the insignificant single digit percentage of their overall earnings for some crazy reason to go out and be healthy and perform at the best, in the best shape of your life, because somebody else is chirping in their ear trying to get that little piece of candy from them instead. Again, my opinion here.
No, I wanted to deep dive into that, Mike, and talk about that, because like I said, you've seen it all. You've been around this for 20 years. So you would have dealt with every type of personality, every type of athlete you could possibly think of. You've dealt with it. I was going to ask, why do you think that is? Why do you think in 2021, like you said, we've got Elon Musk planning to send us to live on Mars. That's no easy feat. That's a lot of money and a lot of brain power to do that. And we kind of do have, we probably have a lot of the answers to this weight cutting problem. We've kind of got it. The science has come a long way. We're not completely there, but we've got a lot of the answers. Why do you think it is that the athletes don't buy into that? And they, like you said, they choose to go down the other path. Why is that?
The humans by nature are lazy, and there's an entitlement mentality. We use the term the 52-week weight cut, in that the athlete should be preparing for competition 52 weeks before they weigh in. If they're an athlete, they're always an athlete. LeBron James doesn't take time off. Kobe Bryant didn't take time off. Tom Brady doesn't take time off. Most of the UFC athletes, real talk right now, will train pretty hard for 6 or 8 weeks during their training camp. And as soon as the fight's over, you try and get them to show up to the gym. You try and get them to show up and get their blood work done, to get in the DEXA scan or a bod pod. You try and get them to adhere to a weight cap. You try and get them to eat healthily, not diet. I hate diets. Like, diet is ridiculous. To live a healthy lifestyle congruent with their goals, they simply won't do that. Why is that? Well, because they're lazy. And there's an entitlement mentality. And then it's their hangers-on, it's that group around them that enables that behavior, because they want to go to the nightclub with them. They want to get through the selfie. They want to do all the fun stuff and get all the gleam and all the shine, while not realizing it's actually the performance that matters. Muhammad Ali said, it's not what happens during the bright lights, it's what happens during the dark hours of the morning. That's what makes champions. Now, and I've been around the world's greatest athletes, Hollywood actors and actresses, like members of the royal family. Like, I work with very high level humans, so high level you'll never hear me mention their name. You might not even know who they are, truly. These people don't fuck around. They do everything they're supposed to do when you are sleeping. Right? This is what I call Sundays my hell day. I try and work harder on Sunday than every other day of the week, because I know everybody's taking Sunday off. And that's just one, and I'm nothing. Like, in the grand scheme of things, like, I'm nothing. I'm just this blue collar guy that's just trying to put some food on his table and take care of his family and set a decent example for a few people I can interact with. But the athletes, and unfortunately, and I've seen it, they piss away their opportunity at greatness. They have a 3 to 10 year window to solidify their legacy, to provide generational wealth. Who is it? I forget, a young man who just retired from the UFC at 30 years old after one fight said, hey, he's retiring essentially because the UFC doesn't provide a 401k. Are you kidding me? You are an independent business owner. You're an independent contractor. You should be operating your own 401k. Like that's silly. It's ridiculous. You're missing the opportunity to become a multimillionaire in retirement simply because you don't embrace the science that's there right now. And on my Instagram page today, I actually broke down in an 8-minute video exactly how he's walking away from about $10 million in retirement income because the people around him, his manager, his agent, his peer group, didn't break down just general tax law, which is I'm not a tax guy, right? Why am I sitting in my Jeep is what I say. Why am I sitting in my Jeep explaining this to this poor kid who's I think is a really nice guy? But again, the athlete is lazy. All athletes, the majority of athletes are not all, right? Very, very, very few exceptions. Lazy and then entitled. Why aren't they doing better? Why isn't the weight cut easier? Well, why aren't they seeking the knowledge to make it such? So it's, you're there, Jordy. Duncan French is there. Clint Waterberg is there. Bo Sandoval is there. Andy Galpin is there. Tyler Minton is there. Like we go through the list. They're there. All the information's there. Damn, go on YouTube. Every one of us has a YouTube channel. We all got widgets and books and eBooks and seminars. God darn, there's so much information that I consume like a faucet 3 hours a day. I'm bathing in knowledge. I'm never going to cut weight. Right. I'm still researching every single day and I'm trying not to even apply it anymore individually. So I'm kind of ranting now again, as I so often do. So I apologize for that. But that's really, it's laziness and entitlement. The information is there. But I think this does cross over to every single person right now. Why are you not as successful as you should be? Well, because you don't work as hard and you haven't done enough to attain that. You simply don't work as hard as you think you do. You're not as good as you think you are. That's what it comes down to. And once we realize that, like, man, I suck at everything. I suck at everything. So Dan, I better try and get a little bit better today. Try and learn a little bit more. Try and make at least one less mistake today than I did yesterday. If the athlete had that mentality, and Lord knows, I could tell some stories. I don't know that I've stumbled across any. Maybe I'll say one athlete so I don't get a phone call after this. I'll say one athlete I stumbled across that actually had that type of humility. Nearly every single one thinks they fucking know everything. And they don't. Clearly they don't.
Hey guys, quick interruption of the podcast to keep you up to date with one of my favorite projects, TrainAid. As you guys know, at the beginning of the year, we launched TrainAid Performance, a scientifically backed supplement company with products that I've personally designed from years of working with world champion fighters, elite businessmen and women, tech giants, and everyday warriors. Our first product, TrainAid Hydration, an electrolyte powder designed to keep you hydrated and fighting through your day, is now available on our website at www.trainaid.com. The feedback we've been getting is absolutely amazing, and I cannot thank you guys enough for all of the support you've shown. So much so that I'm giving my listeners a 15% discount when they apply code HYDRATION15 to checkout, so you can see for yourself why everyone is raving about TrainAid Hydration. All right, back to the show.
Yeah, no, you're spot on, Mike. And I think that's a good segue into this next question, which, like you said, we're still seeing in 2021, lots of athletes miss weight, even at the highest level of the UFC, and even worse when you go down the grade into national level comps and then local level comps. You see it all the time. And like you said, there's a plethora of information out there in 2021 about how to do this. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you still see MMA athletes making when they're attempting to make weight?
They allow their body weight to get too high in the off season. Number one, they don't set composition caps, as we'll call it. They get too far over the weight class. They put on too much non-functional body mass. They lose practice. They lose skill set during the off season simply because they're not training the way they should. They're not managing their body weight. They're in a weight class oriented sport. Weight class matters then. Body weight, total body mass, body composition matters. How many athletes do you deal with? And I know you're a fan of, I mean, I'm a blood panel fiend. How many athletes actually have recent comprehensive blood work outside of their pre-fight medicals? They're like, like none. Well, you fucking, right? Exactly. None. That's pretty easy to get. I mean, cost you $100, maybe online. Everything's online. You can go to your doctor if you have healthcare. You can get this stuff done. So they let their weight get way too high. They get soft in the off season, mentally soft. They think they work so hard. They deserve so much more. Clearly, they do not. Great story. Maybe this will summarize. I'll try not to be as long and rant as much. Bernard Hopkins, this stuck out with me for maybe 20 some odd 30 years. Bernard Hopkins told the story. Bernard Hopkins, one of the greatest middleweights of all time in boxing, right? Just the executioner. I mean, just a legend. I'm a little older, you know, maybe quite a bit older than you, Jordy, at this point. So I grew up kind of doing the, like, almost like the black and white TV with the rabbit ears on the TV watching these fights. And Hopkins was just I'm just like a fan of him. And he didn't have a big fan base, but a fan of his. And he was in prison for years and years, and they got the opportunity to get out of prison. And then he became a world champion. Then he became a millionaire. And he did an interview saying that he had just won, defended his world title, and the co-main event kid who was on the come up. Bernard's walking through the casino. This kid's walking into the casino after the fight. And the kid's like, "Hey, B-Hop, you got to come on. Let's party. Let's party." And he's like, "Party? I'm not partying. Like, I just got my money and I'm going home." He's like, "No, man, you got to celebrate. You got to celebrate." Like this, that. And Hopkins said, "This young man is going to go in and blow it all." He said, "Because I know as soon as I step out of the ring with my hand raised, I got someone else waiting for me. I'm going home. I'm going to bed. I'm going to wake up in the morning. I'm going to get my run in. I'm going to eat my food. And I'm just," he's like, "I got another fight to get ready for." That was the mentality. He was one of the longest reigning middleweight champions of all time at a much older age than the majority. That's the mentality. And I say, like, a George St. Pierre, who's kind of, you know, right there, GSP. What drove George St. Pierre out of the sport, in my opinion, is what also made him great. He was obsessive about his career, obsessive about preparation. Elon Musk is obsessive. You listen to these men talk, these men and women talk, you listen to these A-type performers speak, you watch the way they live, you hear what they say, like, shut your mouth, watch and listen to these humans. George St. Pierre is exceptional. B-Hop was exceptional. Elon Musk, exceptional. These are obsessive human beings. They are not running around, partying up in the clubs, hooting and hollering, putting 40 pounds on in between fights, getting out of the gym, getting soft, risking their careers, risking their fame, risking their, you know, their finances. These are individuals who are focused on the task at hand. And again, Tom Brady, LeBron James, we can think about these other exceptional humans. So for any athlete who might be listening right now, and you're kind of middling, don't do what everybody else does. You must be exceptional. You must be weird. You must do the extraordinary in order to actually stand out, because everyone's the same. Do you think George St. Pierre has the best genetics in MMA? No way. I went to school with three kids who had better genes than George, but they smoke weed, they do coke, they drink alcohol, they stay up too late, they chase girls, they don't pay their bills on time. Poof. Right. And you know, and I, everybody out there knows somebody who, yeah, damn, that kid could do it all. Where is he now? Well, he's in jail. Right. He's, you know, or whatever that sob story becomes. So again, I said I was going to be short, and maybe I was shorter than my normal, you know, answers there.
No, you're completely spot on, Mark. As soon as you said that, I had three or four people just pop in my head, and you're describing them to an absolute T. Mark, this next one, I've seen you, your YouTube is awesome, and everyone listening would be aware of it. There's one video that I saw you put up, and you described something that I think every MMA fan inherently notices when they watch this athlete fight. And I'm talking about Conor McGregor, is that he doesn't necessarily seem like he has the greatest gas tank. And, you know, from the outside, the casual MMA fan might just look at that and just, they're complexed almost. I've had this conversation with people all the time when they're watching it. They're just like, Why is that? Why is Conor, why does he fade off so much in the later rounds? And can you talk us through that?
I can. And I will say, I'm a big Conor McGregor fan. As I said in the video, I'm very respectful of Conor. And just me personally, I don't get political or things like that. Every interaction I've had with Conor McGregor, he calls me coach. I'm not his coach. He's very respectful. Like, so I will make a separation. My personal experience with Conor McGregor has been exceptional. He's been a gentleman. He's been a sportsman, everything up. And he's truly one of my favorite fighters. And he's one of the fighters that I point to and said every athlete should aspire to follow. As I said before, watch him. Don't listen to the gab and the selling the fights and all that stuff. But now, as an aside, Conor struggled in his career. once he get to about minute seven or so, he would start to struggle. You could see all of a sudden the feet get heavy, and man, he's got such great timing and such great power and such great athleticism and such great skill. Conor McGregor would have to dig deep into his bag of tricks because, in my opinion, he was poorly fed, improperly fed. And I don't believe that has anything to do with his training. Now, John Kavanaugh, one of the greatest coaches in MMA. Owen Roddy, one of the greatest striking coaches in MMA. The McGregor Fast Team, to which I know a few of those gentlemen. You know too, Jordy, these are all high-level practitioners. The one flaw, again, and this isn't a bias because I think the guy is a thumb dick, but it's when Conor was working with George Lockhart, George would be bragging about putting his athletes on ketogenic diets. George would be bragging about reducing total caloric consumption of his athletes. Now, I've seen George's programs. I've had athletes and family members and managers and agents contact me to say, like, Dolce, this is what they're sending. What do you think? Why is he telling my athlete to fast for two full days prior to weigh-ins? Real story. Real story. And I'm off camera because I don't know what the athletes want to disclose. I got a phone full of amazing, horrible screenshots and messages and PDFs. It's insane. So when I speak, I'm speaking from a point of honesty and authority. And if anyone with Google can do a little bit of research and start to drill down into what comments were made and such, but also knowing members of the team. What I will say is, since Conor has left George and moved on to Tristan Kennedy, I saw a dramatic change in Conor's physique. I believe there's been a dramatic improvement, though we didn't have a chance to see it in Conor's last fight. Of course, there was a stylistic matchup and Poirier, who I think is amazing, by the way. But again, to get back to the issue, I believe Conor was improperly fueled for the glycolytic sport of mixed martial arts. There is no world that a mixed martial arts athlete should be following a ketogenic diet. Now, we can play with carb cycling and carbohydrate intake, but at no point should we be eliminating carbohydrates for a multitude of days in a row. The amount of extreme dehydration that was occurring is, in my opinion, negligent. I'll use the term. I'm trying to be very careful with my words here. I don't want my personal opinion to bias my professional statements here. I believe, and as you go through Conor's career and you start to look at his fights, including the Mayweather fight, you could see Conor dramatically start to gas out in 3-minute rounds. That should be easy for a five-minute fighter. Those rounds should be extremely easy when you think about the rest time in between slightly different confines, but there's no grappling, there's no wrestling, there's no up-down. There's a lot of changes here. So when we look at the substrate utilization of an athlete like Conor McGregor, a glycolytic athlete performing under the confines of mixed martial arts, I could basically look at the training system and say, well, he was simply under-fueled for this. The weight cut damn near killed him, unfortunately, because in my opinion, it was dramatically mismanaged and has been mismanaged. And you could see the death face that Conor would have, but he wasn't cutting that much weight. Lord knows, Jordy, I've had athletes cut dramatically more weight than a highly tuned athlete like Conor, skipping to the scales. Now, this is not disparaging Conor at all. This is actually a credit to him. As I said in my video, the fact that he was able to go out there and perform at that level, in spite of the negligence, I think is a testimony to his ability as an athlete. But I think you and I, we both understand, man, food is fuel. If all of a sudden, if like I have a Ferrari and I pull out all the gas and I say, all right, now drive the Ferrari. Well, the Ferrari's not going to move. They did not put gas in the Ferrari. All the coaches put all the performance parts on it, but there was no gas in the tank, where there was not enough gas to get the athlete through a 25-minute fight at the highest level. You should never see an athlete like that take a step back, or take a deep breath, get flat-footed, especially one, again, who trains as hard and as long as I know for a fact that Conor was during that period of time.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Mike, can you break it down for us, just for the guys listening? We mentioned there a couple of terms, like it's a glycolytic sport. Can you talk to us? And we use the analogy of the Ferrari there. And in my opinion, your opinion, Conor is a Ferrari, right? Like, he's one of the best MMA athletes in history, period. Why is that ketogenic diet so destructive for a sport like MMA and an athlete like Conor?
Well, Now, regardless of what your favorite podcast host may entertain as a guest because they simply have to fill time, right? Think about that. All the information in the world, Dr. Phil's show, Dr. Oz's show, and all the other podcasts out there that we are inundated with. You think about how often the narrative changes. I've been in this game for a long time, since the 1993. I opened up my training business, right? So I've seen many generations of exclusionary, restrictive, fad dietary practices come through. I've seen the ketogenic diet come through multiple times. Now, the ketogenic diet essentially is predicated upon the attainment of metabolic ketosis. Well, how do you attain metabolic ketosis? Number one, it's very difficult. It's very difficult for any human. It's especially difficult for a human who is eating carbohydrate, who is normally consuming glycogen or storing eating carbohydrate, which is then stored in the muscle and the liver as glycogen. And then it is expressed as glucose, as the primary fuel source for the brain, but also for muscular activity. And that's really what I'll focus on for this conversation. So when we say a glycolytic athlete or glycolytic activity, well, this is requiring glycogen, glucose stored as glycogen, right? So carbohydrate consumed, stored as glycogen, expressed as glucose for that activity. Mixed martial arts is a glycolytic sport. We require glucose to compete in mixed martial arts. We require glucose for moderately intense muscular contraction. Now, there's different substrates that are utilized outside of just glucose per se at the higher levels of muscular exertion. But at the base level, glycogen is key here. To deprive an athlete of glycogen is to inhibit the athlete's ability to perform in a glycolytic activity simply because there is no glucose, there's no stored glycogen. There is that, therefore, there's no usable glucose. Then the body has to rely upon free fatty acids to actually become the fuel source for muscular activity, but it's very inefficient and it's not even localized, which is another issue. Where glycogen is actually stored specific, Andy Galpin actually blew up Dr. Dom D'Agostino's conversation about ketosis years ago on Joe Rogan's show. And it was Andy's just so great and so deadpan. And Joe was like, well, Dr. D'Agostino, to get his name correctly, he's a smart guy, both PhDs, and I think maybe this will help. Dr. Dom D'Agostino has a PhD. Dr. Andy Galpin has a PhD. Well, these are two equals in many ways. Well, Dr. D'Agostino is saying a ketogenic diet and ketosis is a much more beneficial state of being and fuel substrate for athletic activity. Andy Galpin comes in and sits down and says, well, that makes no sense because the glycogen is actually stored right in the muscle that it needs to be utilized like that. Readily available glucose, bang, we're ready to go without getting, you know, deep into the breakdown and ATP and all the other things. So that being said, using or living in ketosis, creating a ketogenic state, bringing athlete towards ketosis, robbing an athlete of glycogen when they most need it prior to the most important glycolytic activity of their entire life, which is a 15 to 25 minute mixed martial arts bout, which is completely glycolytic, from the beginning of the warm-up through the end of the fight, we require glycogen. And some of these teams, because they are incompetent, they don't understand, all they know is that glycogen binds with water, therefore the athlete gains weight. If I pull the glycogen, the water will drop, the athlete will get lighter, and then they say, oh, same thing with sodium. I'll pull the sodium, I'll pull the carbohydrate, less water will stick to the athlete will then get lighter, the athlete will make weight, I'll look like I know what I'm doing, then the athlete goes out there and gasses out, sometimes during warm-up. I've seen it backstage with other athletes before, and some of these athletes who work with this individual, I've seen it before. They're like, fuck, I can't feel my legs. Like labored breathing, like you see it all of a sudden, their body's just fuck it, they're bonking out in the warm-up, which is, this is a shit show right now. And then we talk about it. I'm getting, you know, too passionate now. Then we see what happens with anxiety, and we see the stress hormones start to pump into the athlete during the warm-ups because now they're freaking out because they don't have enough energy to get through their warm-up. And all of a sudden, this negative psychological cascade starts to kick in, and then the music plays. Then they got to go out there and they got to fight that fucking monster who's been training for them and calling them out and talking shit about their girlfriend in the media. And they've been on a ketogenic diet. And also, more recently, they were told to fast for 2 days prior to weigh-ins. I mean, you want to talk about just a shit show getting worse and worse. This is what's happening. And I kind of even forget the beginning of the question right now. But, oh, what is glycolytic? Glycolytic simply means requiring glycogen. You know, I always say stored glycogen expressed as glucose for athletic activity. But, I mean, moderately athletic activity. We utilize glucose for MMA. It's almost completely glycolytic, I would say.
Yeah, you're spot on. Hey, Mike. And it's that old saying that, you know, a lot of fighters will say like making weight is the fight before the fight. And they often forget that there's a fight after that. Like, it's not just about making weight, right? Like, you've got to fight another human being. So I want to get your insights into this, and we've touched on it a bit, but why is it like it, knowing everything that you just said, knowing that say a ketogenic diet isn't ideal for performance in this sport. Like we said, we've got people like Elon Musk sending people to Mars. In 2021, we've got all this science. Why is it that someone at that level, at the most elite level, who's got all these spotlights, why do they buy into that? Why is it that they'll buy into that and then follow it and believe it that it'll actually help their performance? How does that happen?
Well, what I said earlier, humans are lazy and humans are entitled. They believe they're better than they are. They believe they're more capable than they are. And they're too lazy to put the work in, by and large. Also, I differentiate fitness marketers and fitness experts. Fitness marketers are sexy. They sell the sizzle. Fitness experts aren't. You and I, Jordy, I mean, to be fair, I want to speak for you. I'm kind of a boring guy. If you go to my Instagram, you don't see me trying to flex up with all the famous people I know. You don't see me running around trying to like oversell my stuff. I never, ever utilize. I mean, I'm like, the only time I use like a before and after for me is when the person really asks me to do it. I have tens of thousands of before and after, hundreds of thousands of testimonials over my 20 some odd years. You look at my social media and the way that I engage and do business. I'm not a fitness marketer, though I work in the fitness space. I'm a fitness educator. I'm a fitness expert. You know, I humbly would say that. When we get individuals who will falsify their resumes, they will over promise and eventually under deliver. And we see, you know, a high attrition rate with their services and a lot of, you know, behind the scenes, you know, negative chatter, let's say. And everyone in the industry knows what I'm talking about right now. But also the price point. I mean, I know a lot of people in our industry right now, they will work for tweets. They will work for a plane ticket. They will not, they know that their services are not worthy of a paycheck. So they will barter for ego. They will barter for proximity and association. And the athlete is too damn lazy and too damn entitled to pay true professionals what they are actually worth. And also, I will point to the managers and to the agents and to the support systems for enabling and allowing that. That's the issue. Why would you work with someone who has multiple athletes who have been sent to the hospital and there are headline after headline after headline after headline of a multitude of athletes saying, I almost died. I thought I was going to die. The doctor said I almost died. Well, these individuals, because it's not just one, they will then go on and falsify their resume and falsify their success. In any other industry, they would be brought up on charges. They would likely face criminal charges for this. It's somehow MMA and the UFC, well, I'll say MMA because there's other organizations. This is still very much the Wild West. It is very much unregulated, and it's unfortunate. Now, there's a standard of practice here in the United States where there's federal guidelines and then there's state by state guidelines. And this is a little bit, you know, iffy. I am not a registered dietitian. I do not have that designation, to which I deeply respect, which is why I pay for registered dietitians, all with advanced Master of Sciences degrees on my staff. Not one sheet of paper, not one piece of information leaves my office, and definitely not one program, personalized program, leaves my office without being 100% vetted for its validity, and especially with regards to medical nutrition therapy in working with any human being, regardless of what their career or sport may be. And the fact that many of these individuals are just throwing these bro templates out there at the expense of the athlete, not just their career, but their long-term health outcome. What happens, Jordy, and you know probably better than anyone, what happens when a dehydrated athlete gets a shin kick to the skull at minute 14 of a 15-minute grueling fight to which they lost 6 or 8 pounds in water while competing? I think Daniel Cormier said something to the effect of like he lost like 7 pounds or something while fighting John Jones or one of his fights. That's sweating while competing. Now, if he had a mismanaged weight cut in the lead up to that, he had a poor rehydration going into that, and then he was further dehydrated another 3, 4, 5% of total body mass, and then the shin kick comes to the skull. What is the long-term outcome of that? I'm keenly aware of that as a extreme possibility for any human I ever work with. So that being said, why do the athletes fall into it? Man, the information's there. You doing what you're doing, and hopefully me kind of being as prickly and confrontational as I can to make people see this and hear this and understand this, that this is actually happening, and there are really bad actors out there taking advantage of the athletes, and it should be stopped, and it should not be condoned, and every manager is responsible for allowing it, and every agent is responsible for allowing it, and every head coach is responsible for allowing it, every family member and spouse of the athlete is responsible, but ultimately, it's the athlete's responsibility. And until the athlete starts stepping up and starts demanding more and starts operating as if the athlete is Elon Musk and surrounds themselves with that level of expertise and experience and integrity around them as their C-suite executives, it won't change. But the athlete also has to approach their craft the same way Elon approaches his. When will that happen? Well, hopefully that happens soon. But I don't know. I'm not very optimistic.
Yeah, no, I think I don't think you're missing the mark too much there, Mike. I think you're pretty on the bullseye with that. I said that was the last question and I lied. And I know that we're hitting time now. You've been in this for so long. You've seen it all. You've seen the whole nine yards. What do you think should be done to make this weight cutting issue safer?
Great, great question, Jordan. Thank you for the opportunity to answer this. I've been in the game, this portion of the game, as long or longer than anyone, right? At this level, specifically at the highest level, I know every state commission, I know every expediter, I know all the ops, I know all the teams, I know the majority of the athletes, I know the doctors, like I'm on the inside. I know what the contracts look like. I know how much everybody's getting freaking paid. I know what the side letters are that aren't in the contract. I know all this stuff. So when I'm going to make this statement, I know this. I'm an insider. I've been an insider for so long. I just know it like it's boilerplate now. There's been a lot of attempts to regulate weight cutting, and most start with positive intention. And then they get blurred in bureaucracy and ego and narcissism. That happens. So we have what California is trying to do, and Andy Foster in California have the 8-pointer, the 10-point system for weight cutting. That's great attempt by Andy, who's a great guy, but it's a complete failure, and it's so easy. You and I right now, I can legally cheat every single one of his points and be laughing at it, right? I have 13-year-old wrestlers in New Jersey right now that we can blow hydration tests 20 pounds lighter than we should legally. Like, I got athletes in 1FC right now. And 1FC, by the way, they don't drug test in 1FC. Everyone talks about how great their hydration testing is. They don't drug test in 1FC, by the way. Like, they're so healthy. And I'm friends with people at 1FC. Every organization is different. And I only say this, that there's no perfect scenario. The only thing that will work, regulation will not work. In that regulating body weight will not work. The only thing that will work is financial penalty. These are prize fighters. There must be extreme financial repercussions for a weight class miss. What would that be? For me, it would be a minimum of a 50% total purse reduction or total purse penalty that goes to your opponent. It doesn't go to the stupid athletic commission. The athletic commission's not in there fighting. They should not get a penny of the athlete's purse who misses weight most of the time to gain advantage. So if the athlete misses weight, first time, it should be a mandatory 50% total. That's pay-per-view money. That's side letter money. That's every penny they make. 50% should go to the opposition, flat out. And then the opposition should be guaranteed their show money and then the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to fight the cheater. Because missing weight to me is cheating. You are cheating the contract flat out. If an athlete misses weight, number one, first time they miss weight, and I have thought about this, it should be a mandatory 50% financial penalty and a minimum of a 6-month suspension where they must undergo rigorous medical testing to make sure they are truly healthy to come back and compete. And I would love to see the UFCPI set the criteria of what exactly does that mean. And I think Duncan and the team can do a great job to actually set that criteria to ensure 6-month penalty. You miss weight, you are not healthy. You shouldn't be competing in combat sports anyway, by the way. And I wouldn't be upset to see every athlete who misses weight is immediately pulled off the card and the athlete, the opposition, is paid their full rate. That likely won't happen because of the sport and the entertainment and the public expectation and television deals. Second time an athlete misses weight, it should be like a failed drug test. It should be a 2-year suspension. You can't make money for the next 2 years because you tried to cheat the scale or you were so unprofessional 12 weeks, 16 weeks, 24 weeks before your fight, you let your weight blow up so high. To close this, in my opinion, the only way to curtail extreme weight cutting and unhealthy weight cutting is to have a severe financial penalty. Clearly, we've shown that the athletes will continue to miss weight. All the regulation in the world right now, the athletes are still missing weight, right? They won't cut more weight because simply the athlete can't cut any more weight than they're currently cutting. We must penalize them to disincentivize them from trying to make these bigger cuts. And hopefully the athletes start moving to bigger weight classes. I'd love to see athletes competing within 5% of their walk around weight, right? Like the European model, maybe, where they're walking around 4% above their weight class, 8% maybe, if they're really, you know, packing on some weight or so. These athletes are getting up 20% above their weight class, right? You and I both know, we're hired sometimes to fix that. That's not money. I don't want that money. I don't want that job, right? I want my job to be so freaking boring. I just want to keep the athlete healthy year long. Make the weight cut an easy thing. I'd rather work with general population and help regular folks be healthy, live long lives, and then give a little bit of consultation to the athletes kind of long-term than see these athletes trying to kill themselves to squeeze into a smaller weight class. For what purpose anyway? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and we're coming full circle, right, to the ethos and the philosophy that we touched on about your company and you personally as a practitioner. Is that you're a longevity company, right? And that's the thing, is like doing these huge weight cuts, 20-25%. I think even Mike, you agree, 20 years ago, we didn't know what that was doing in the body. But now, 2021, we have good case studies. We have good studies showing what that's doing in the body. And newsflash, everyone, it's not good. It's not good, like Mike's saying. Yeah, it's not a good thing. It's not helping your longevity at all. And like you said, Mike, it's why you're seeing these guys at 50 years old. And they're all messed up. And it, you know, we can't say indefinitely that was because you're cutting a lot of weight, but I think you and I both know probably played a big part in it. Didn't do them any favors. So, and I like it, Mike. I like the financial penalty because me and one of my athletes, we spoke about this in Abu Dhabi last year when one of our guys, his opponent missed weight. And I think Israel said it publicly in the media event and said, you know what, like take 50, 60%, see if they miss weight. See if they miss weight when you're taking 50, 60%. On probably not that lucrative of a deal as it is, and see how serious they take it. So I think if we did that, Mike, and they followed your advice, you'd see a seismic shift in that weight cutting culture. And I think you're absolutely spot on. Mike, I'm super conscious of your time. I do want to say thank you for coming on. I know I say this to all my guests. I know you're really, really busy. So I appreciate, Mike. I appreciate everything you've done for the industry. Godfather of combat sports nutrition. Like I said at the start, none of us would be doing what we're doing if you didn't lay the foundation, you know, 20 years ago at Henzo Gracie as a high school junior starting physical enterprise, you know. So we thank you for that, Mike. Thank you for everything you're putting out. I'm sure everyone listening in already follows you on Instagram, follows you on socials, follows you on YouTube. Just in case they're not getting the good stuff, can you tell us where they can find all the information you put out?
Just type in the Dolce Diet. So it's our .com, Instagram, YouTube. Type in the Dolce Diet, whatever you're looking for, you will certainly find us. And I try and be as accessible as possible. I answer DMs. I do live chats almost every day on YouTube, on Instagram. I really do see myself at this stage in my career. I am just here to help people live longer, better, healthier lives so they can be there with their families. They can provide greater value. They can pass down their wisdom. We can share more great experiences to spread just positive energy. I mean, that's my whole goal and focus right now. So whatever I can do to help people live better lives, to add value to their lives, that's what I'm here for, man. And I'm super proud of you, Jordy, respectfully as peers here, to see what you've done, to see what you're growing, to see the direction that you're taking your company, to see the amazing work that you're putting out there that is rare. And from where I stand, you stand out. You certainly stand out from the industry, from what the majority of those here are doing. And I see, you know, you and I, we know each other behind the scenes a little bit, getting to know each other more and more, which is an honor. And I just wanted to take a moment and really say, like, what deep respect I have for you and for what you're currently doing, what you've done thus far, of course, your body of work, what you are continuing to do, because I see your trajectory and your scale and I see what you're doing, but also I see that the passion that you have for your athletes, the care that goes into your athletes. You're not just an Instagram hunter, like the majority, unfortunately, of those in this industry. You are actually there for the human behind the profile. And that's really where I'm going to give you most respect. So, you know, many blessings and much respect to you, my friend.
No, I appreciate it, Mike. And very similar to you. It's hard not to get close to your athletes. And, you know, it strikes home when you talk about the longevity, right? Like, When you get to know these guys, you start to know them as people and you start to know their family, you start to know their partner, their kids. And it's always in the front of your mind, isn't it? It's like, is what I'm doing going to allow them to be the best dad that they can be, to be the best husband that they can be, the best wife, you know, the best partner? Is what I'm doing going to allow them to have kids when they turn 30 to 35? So, Mike, I really align with those values of the longevity. And it's been so good having you on, Mike. I'm very conscious of your time. I've said it about three times, but I'll let you go now, Mike. I'm sure we'll do it again, no doubt. Mike Dolce, thank you so much for coming on.
A pleasure, Jordy. Thank you.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Mike is a leader in the health and fitness industry and has more experience working with elite-level combat athletes than anyone in the game. Again, his website is thedolcediet.com and his YouTube is under his name. Be sure to follow along with him so you do not miss a beat with anything that is happening in the industry. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.